Ink and Paint wishes to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded and edited. It is a great privilege to be able to tell stories on this land, which has a tradition of storytelling stretching back over 10,000 years. We also wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from all over the world where our guests record from. We pay our respects to all elders past, present, and emerging, and to our First Nations listeners. Hello, and welcome to Ink and Paint In Betweeners, our series of bonus episodes expanding on the story of the Disney animated classics. I'm your host, Daniel Lamon. In these short bonuses, we're sharing history and stories related to the Disney animated classics that sit just outside of the films themselves and complement our main Ink and Paint episodes. One of the great joys of making Ink and Paint has been delving into the incredible research done by academics and historians all over the world, who have devoted their blood, sweat, and tears to telling the story of Walt Disney and his company. Sometimes that research comes as audio commentaries or documentaries, and sometimes as books, impressive volumes full of tantalizing historical facts and beautiful archival artwork and photos. In our episode on the package films of the 1940s, I was able to chat with one of the most respected Disney historians working today, J.B. Kaufman, who is responsible for many of the most impressive books on Disney history. In fact, his book, South of the Border with Disney, was an invaluable resource for our episode on the South American Good Neighbor films. It was a real treat just to have the opportunity to talk to Mr. Kaufman, but the super nerd in me couldn't miss the chance to ask him about how he goes about constructing these invaluable books. So, at the end of the interview, Mr. Kaufman was generous enough to spend a few minutes talking with me about his process, his experiences in the Disney archives, and what some of his dream research projects would be. When you start the process of, you know, looking into a particular film for a particular writing project or a particular research project, what is your process? Where do you start? So, for example, with, you know, doing a project like the book, your recent book on Fun and Fancy Free, how do you go about a research project like that?
Well, in that particular case, I had kind of a head start because I had written a book on the making of Pinocchio. And as part of my deep research on Jiminy Cricket, I like to tell people that writing a book is basically just an excuse to do the research.
Yes. Well, I mean, this podcast was an excuse for me to spend 2 years of my life reading and learning about Disney, so I completely sympathize with that.
Well, yeah, that it is the case that the research is the fun part. So in the case of Pinocchio, I wanted to know everything I could about Jiminy Cricket, and so that was a great excuse to learn about the Jiminy Cricket sequences in Fun and Fancy Free. So I had kind of a head start. But the more generic answer is that, of course, none of these things could be done without visiting the Disney archives. When you do any amount of research on silent film history, you kind of get used to a world in which you really have to scrape for any little bits of research material you can find on, you know, whatever film is at hand. And you feel really, really lucky if you actually manage to come up with something. With Disney, with the Disney studio, you're kind of at the opposite end of that spectrum because they did a magnificent job of preserving almost everything. There are also different areas within the company. There's the Walt Disney Archives proper, which maintains production files, you know, all kinds of written records. There is actually a separate department within the company called the Animation Research Library, which is actually in a separate building and not even on the lot in Burbank. And that's where the animation art itself is preserved. Now, this is getting into the weeds a little bit, but as a general rule, written material is at the archives. Artistic material is at the ARL. However, one of the things that happened when they moved all of the animation pencil art to the ARL is that they moved the exposure sheets along with it. Now, as you may know, it was the practice whenever an animator tackled a scene, there would be an exposure sheet to go with that scene. And the exposure sheet would travel with the scene all the way through the production process. And ultimately was used by the camera operator to shoot the scene when it was finished. Now, that's important because, you know, when you're at the archives, you may go through the draft, which was the assignment sheet, where animators were assigned individual scenes, and you know, with the footage of the scene and so on. So there's that, but there's also the exposure sheet, which usually will reflect changes that took place during production. You know, it wasn't uncommon for the footage of the scene to change, you know, because the animator might say, well, I need, you know, another 10 feet to make the character move the way he should, you know, in this section of the scene. Or there might be, you know, any number of reasons why the footage would change. Sometimes the scene is recast with a different animator. You know, there are any number of changes that can happen. And as a rule, those changes will be reflected in the exposure sheet. Now, it's a lot of work to go through those, but it's worth it because there's so much you can learn from that. And if you have the draft and the exposure sheet, you've kind of got the before and after of, you know, creating the scene. You know, it takes a long time to dig through all that, but it's amazing how much you can learn that way. So that's mind you, that's just one step of the process. There's also story development, you know, from starting in the mid 30s, about the time they were getting serious about Snow White, they would have transcriptions of their story conferences, and you know, you can learn a lot about the creative process that they went through to develop the story. So those things are very important. And there's also the photo library, where they have literally millions of photos, not only production stills and scene stills, but in some cases, things that are even tangential to that. Walt with some of the, you know, the top artists in the studio and so on. And those, mind you, are just the resources that are within the Disney studio. With some projects, for instance, with Snow White, for example, I wrote actually two books.
Yes, two giant books. Quite amazing to think that you were able to come up with two enormous volumes on the one film.
Well, it was, believe me, it was a treat to get the opportunity to do that. But in the course of that, I wound up kind of giving myself a crash course in the history of folklore, because the story of Snow White, as you know, goes back many centuries before the Brothers Grimm. So there was so much to know about that. Well, in the case of the South American films, you know, the whole Good Neighbor project was undertaken at the request of the U.S. government, which means that there was a lot of documentation in the National Archives in Washington. Not only that, but the coordinator's office was headed by Nelson Rockefeller, which meant that the Rockefeller Family Archives in New York State had a lot of material that didn't show up anywhere else. So if you really follow all of these trails, the research can be a wonderful learning opportunity in many ways, not all of which are contained within the Disney studio.
And then once you have all that material, how do you go about starting to write a volume on it? Like how you have this enormous, massive resources. How do you condense that? How do you begin to condense that into a book?
The simple answer is that you just jump in and start writing. And I mean, usually by the time, at least for me, by the time I get to that point, I have a rough idea of how I would like to break down the story. And, you know, you write an outline, the kind of the traditional outline that we all learn to do in school. And for me, the outline helps a lot structurally, but it's only a guide. You know, if I find that the writing is going in such a way that it doesn't exactly conform to the outline, that's okay. You know, it's you want something that's going to flow well for the reader. I can tell you that when I first started doing this, my thought was that first I would go out and do the research, and then when I came back and knew everything about the subject, then I would write about it. It turns out that when for me anyway, when I start writing, I discover that the learning process isn't over yet, because once you start writing and turning these things over in your mind, you start making connections and thinking, well, now, wait a minute, there must be something more to this that I don't know yet, and I need to go back and research some more. So the writing and the research are not mutually exclusive. You know, one really bleeds into the other. And if everything is clicking right, you know, you can wind up continuing to learn about the film all the way through the writing process.
What's the most surprising thing that you've discovered in your research on any of the Disney projects that you've had to look into? What's been has there been one particular piece of information that really took you by surprise?
The thing that I was just telling you about a while ago, Sooner or Later, that was a tremendous surprise. And I have to wonder whether they seriously thought that Walt would consider making a film along those lines, because it's so unlike anything that they had done or frankly ever did do.
And very meta-textual. And that's not a thing that you would associate with Disney animation, is an idea of like meta storytelling.
Right, right. It was so far out in left field, which I have to think came more from Teehee. You know, I never met him, but I did do a number of interviews with Bill Cottrell, and he was a wonderful guy, but he was very sort of serious and thoughtful. I have to think that he was not coming up with the wildest ideas behind that story.
The last question I wanted to ask about your research process, though, is, are there any projects that you've always wanted to look into that you haven't had a chance to yet? Or ones that you think deserve to be given the time and the space to be researched and understood that haven't had that opportunity yet?
I would say the answer is yes. And I mean, I have multiple projects in the works at any given time. One that I'm working on right now wasn't my idea. This one kind of came to me. I am collaborating with the granddaughter of Clarence Nash on a biography of him.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's amazing.
I'm kind of excited about that one, because, you know, biography is normally not my thing, but her name is Margaret Barnes, and she was tackling it just because of the family connection. He was her grandfather and she loved him, and she has a ton of family memorabilia that, you know, was saved from his career. You know, even though I don't normally have that much interest in biographies, through her, I've been learning a lot about him. And he turns out to be a really interesting character. We know about his talent, and we've all grown up hearing his Donald Duck voice. He turns out to have been a really good, down-to-earth, sort of salt of the earth kind of guy. And he had a really interesting career, both within and outside the Disney studio. You know, at the same time in the 1940s that he was doing all those great Donald Duck soundtracks, he also had a parallel career going in radio. He had some back and forth with Roy Disney about that, but the arrangement they came up with was he could do animal sounds and even a duck's voice, as long as it wasn't a talking duck. That was kind of the big thing that set Donald apart, was that he was a talking duck. So Clarence could do these duck imitations as long as he wasn't speaking words. And he had a long radio career with Burns and Allen and other great performers on the radio.
How supportive are the Disney archives, the Walt Disney Company, the Walt Disney Family Museum? How supportive are they and encouraging are they of works on the history of Walt, on the history of the films, and the history of the company?
In general, I would say that they are very, very supportive. Now, it is also the case that, of course, you know, these are their, you know, these films and so on are their valued properties, and they are very, very careful about, you know, what they allow and how the subject is depicted. I think I've worked with them enough times now that they know that I'm not going to go out there and slander Walt Disney. that doesn't mean that I have automatically have a ticket to ride. You know, every new project is a new project. You're kind of starting over again at square one. So they want to know, you know, kind of what I have in mind and so on. You know, once I have explained all of that and they have an idea of where I'm going with it, I haven't had them reject anything yet, because I think they do. You know, it's a huge company, and a lot of people who work there just think of it as a job, or just as a company. But there are people within the company, and especially at the archives, who really do appreciate the artistic legacy of Walt Disney and the importance of these films and so on in history. So I think when they know that you're for real and they believe in, you know, what you're doing, they tend to be very, very supportive and very helpful, and even will volunteer material that, you know, that you might not have known to ask about. I know when I was working on Pinocchio, for example, Robert Tiemann at the archives, he's not there anymore, but he was one of the archivists there. And he said, you know, if you're going to be working on Pinocchio, you should know about the, we have all of the cutting records. Are you interested in seeing those? And I said, you bet I'd be interested. And then I said, what are cutting records?
I was about to say, I've never heard that phrase before. What on earth is a cutting record?
And he said, well, I don't know, but if I bring them in, you'll see, and then we'll both know. So he brought them in, and it turned out that cutting records, in this case, I mean, that can mean different things, you know, between different studios. But in this case, cutting records are the equivalent of daily production reports at a live action studio, which means that whenever there was a recording session or even a live action filming session, because, you know, they filmed live action for reference or for any number of things, whenever something like that took place, there would be a cutting record to document that. And whenever they were recording, if it was a dialogue session, they would have the lines of dialogue that were being recorded, the number of takes, the punch numbers for each take, and then which ones were selected for production. For music, it was even more complicated than that. If it was an orchestra session, they would list the names of the performers who were in the orchestra.
That's an incredible resource. That's like a Bible to understanding the production process of that film.
It is. And it turned out, at least according to Robert, Pinocchio was the only film for which all of the cutting records were preserved. And when he brought them in, there was a cart with eight big loose leaf binders full of these things. And I went through every one of them. And it, just like with the exposure sheets that I was telling you about, there's a lot you can learn from those things. And this basically, this was an example of them volunteering things, because I would never have known to ask for the cutting records, but they were, you know, they were so forthcoming and so helpful that, you know, thanks to that invaluable help, we now have the benefit of the knowledge that you could get out of those things.
As someone sitting on the other side of the world in Australia, I can only... The Disney Archives are one of those places that just seems like a magical, mythical place to me. The idea that there can be a place where all of, like, the complete history of an art form and all of these incredible artists are kind of accumulated in the one place where you can see, you know, the brushstrokes on Tyrus Wong's background and artwork on Bambi, or that you can see Gustav Tengren's, you know, the detail in his art, in his background artwork on Pinocchio and stuff like that. What was it like the first time you went in there? I have to, that, as the last question, I have to ask that. What was like the first time you were able to go into the Disney archives?
Well, you can probably imagine it was just, even just driving onto the lot, it was like a primal experience. It was like, you know, you were sort of coming home for, you know, after a lifetime of just imagining this place. I don't think I can put it any more articulately than that. It was just like something coming true after years of just being an illusion in your mind. You know, it was discovering that this place really is real, and it was just as wonderful. And in fact, a lot of the research that I did there to start with was about films made in the 1930s, which of course were made at the Hyperion Studio. It wasn't until I did the book on the South American films, which had been produced after they moved into the Burbank Studio, that, you know, I had that thrill of being on the lot and being at the archives and being in the actual physical location where the films had been made. You know, to think, you know, I'm standing where they stood. That was a whole new level of excitement to that. And I, you know, I talked to the people there about, you know, I hope that they don't get jaded and just, you know, after a while, just take it for granted and not have that enjoyment. And I'm happy to say that a number of people there at the archives have reassured me that they still get that same thrill every time they walk onto the lot.
Thanks for listening to this In-Betweener bonus episode. And thanks once again to J.B. Kaufman for chatting with me about his work. You can find more information on Mr. Kaufman's books and research at jbkaufman.com and hear the rest of our interview on episode 10 of Ink and Paint, The Package Films. Be sure to check out the show notes on all our episodes so far at inkandpaint.com.au, including artwork, archival photographs, and the history of each of the films on home video. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the podcast. Hit us up with your comments, questions, or even memories of your favourite Disney films, and we'll be sure to share them on our upcoming episodes. You can email Daniel at inkandpaint.com.au or find me on Twitter at Daniel Lemon. You can also follow Ink and Paint on Twitter and Instagram at InkPaintPod for bonus material and news on upcoming episodes. We release new in-betweeners as we go along, so make sure you subscribe to Ink and Paint to make sure you don't miss any. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to rate and review and to tell your friends about us. Ink and Paint In-Betweeners are created, hosted, and written by myself, Daniel Lemon, and produced and edited by Alex Amster. Theme music is composed by Sam Porter. The show artwork is designed by Nicholas Piranakis, and the podcast is released through Switch, maketheswitch.com.au. Join in next time on Ink and Paint to continue our journey through the Disney animated classics.